TJ Maxx, 200 stores, Ross, 150 stores, Aldi, 250 per year into an inventory of shopping centers that's not growing at all. So different than multifamily, different than industrial, all this new products coming on here in the shopping center sector, you have no new product, but you have all of these growth retailers that are growing into an inventory that's not growing. So if you own a shopping center, an open air center at 60, 70, 80% of replacement costs in a viable market, just by definition, that's a good story. Okay. If you own an enclosed mall at a 15 cap in a viable market, that's an even better story.
Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. I'm here with Omar Eltaraya, our Senior Director of Research, to provide you with the latest news and trends in the commercial real estate market. We're excited to have a special guest on with us today, Andy Weiner of Rockstep Capital, to talk about retail. Andy's the founder and president of Rockstep Capital, a Houston-based investment firm that has acquired or developed more than 9 million square feet of shopping centers across the country. He grew up in the family retail business, Weiner Stores, before launching Rockstep in 1997, and today focuses on revitalizing shopping centers in hometown markets through local partnerships. He's also very active on social media as the Shopping Center Guy. Andy, thanks for coming with us on CRE Exchange. Omar, I'll turn it over to you to get us kicked off.
So, Andy, would love to dive into background and kind of the origin story. I know you come from a family retail legacy. How did that really shape your understanding of operations, and how'd that lead to you coming into real estate ownership?
Sure. Our family business, started by my grandfather in Houston in the 1920s, was our family name, Weiner Stores, and him and his two sons, one of my father, founded and grew this company to 159 clothing stores. So it was a regional retail operation. Men's, women's, kids, shoes, budget pricing, the size of a TJ Maxx, half of them in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, New Orleans, half of them in county seat towns, smaller communities. So I grew up running the operations for the company, store operations, real estate. That's how I learned about shopping centers, finance, systems, logistics, HR. I am a student of retail. I think I understand retail. I understand the dynamics what's happening with Amazon and the issues of trip capture and how people are competing with Amazons and how retailers operate, how they grow, store metrics. So I'm a retailer at heart, and shopping centers is really a study about the strength and viability of your tenants, which are usually, but not always, retailers.
And was there any pivotal moment that really gave you the courage to jump into and launch Rockstep in 96?
Well, basically, there was a metaphorically fire in the building and had to jump out a window. The company went out of business because we were competing with Walmart. And a lot of companies just don't survive the kind of buying power that Walmart had. And then we had some issues about strategy in our company that were not, I call it A+. Even if they were A+, we might not have survived against Walmart anyway. So the company ended up closing, liquidating, and I started doing shopping center investing in 1997.
And do you mind telling us a little bit about that first deal and what that experience was early on?
Yeah, the first deal was a wild deal. It's basically outside my window in Houston. I started doing development opportunities, and at the corner of Ella and 610 on the North Loop, I decided I was going to assemble 23 tracts of land simultaneously and close a ditch and close a city street and sell all of that package to Lowe's. And so there's a Lowe's right outside my window, kind of small world by chance that one of our investors owned an office building next to that Lowe's deal. And I ended up officing as a result because we got a good deal on our rent next to my first deal, which is outside my window.
That's fantastic. And I guess all the knowledge and kind of experience from the operating side, have you been able to translate that into your strategy today?
Well, look, the answer is yes, but in many dimensions. So I have been in hundreds of Walmart stores, hundreds, maybe 500 Walmart stores. I've been in 1,000 or 2,000 markets. I've been in and seen and driven by and looked at thousands of shopping centers. And I've walked in thousands of stores and looked at inventory and inventory per foot and the quality of performance inside the store. And I've studied retail management and store metrics. Store metrics is if a retailer invests certain amount of capital, both for fixtures and inventory net of payables, what is the return on investment for a prototypical store? That's called store metrics. And a grocery store might have a 10 or 12% return. A TJ Maxx might have a 25 or 30% return. And you look at these different store metrics and you start to look at what does it take for a store to be profitable? Okay. What is the kind of rent? Are they paying too much rent? Do they have the opportunity to pay more rent? And so you start to look at those, and you also look at quality of management, and do they have the right strategy? Can they compete against Amazon? Can they develop their own e-commerce strategy to protect, if not grow, market share against Amazon? So those are some of the things that, as a retailer by background, I study, I think about, and it helps very much understanding the risk and the opportunity in the shopping center sector.
And I know that improving communities is really close to your core mission, and that factors into overall your portfolio as well as your firm strategy. Where does that passion come from?
You know, I had a pivot, and we could call it a rock step, but we're going to get there in a little bit. About 15, 18 years ago, where I started working with Tractor Supply. And I started my shopping center career doing Walmarts, again, the company that put us out of business. But I ended up working with them to do Walmarts in the Houston region. And then I tried to do a Walmart outside of College Station, Texas, and Tractor Supply wanted that track. I started a relationship with them, and I did a series of 12 Tractor Supplies in Southeast Texas and Southern Louisiana. And I've done a lot of Tractor Supplies since then. And I started working in non-major metro towns. We now call them hometowns. And these are secondary, tertiary markets. And we started playing in 2010 in the enclosed mall space, as well as the open air grocery and the open air non-grocery space. And we came to realize that these assets are a huge opportunity and very challenging to manage. And that if a mall goes dead, it's very bad image-wise and quality of life-wise for that hometown. And so our mission has become to make hometowns better. And we'll talk a little bit about what is the definition of a hometown. But our mission is to make hometowns better by bringing capital and expertise to assets that affect quality of life. And the enclosed malls are the trickiest asset, and I think the biggest opportunity in commercial real estate. And so we're experts. We have a lot of experience. We've learned a lot of lessons in that space.
So Andy, I think that's a good transition. We want to talk to you a little bit about an overview of the company. Do you mind telling our listeners what your portfolio looks like, say how many centers or square footage, maybe the size of your team?
Yeah, we're based in Houston. We have built or acquired actually 10 million square feet of shopping centers as of about 5 weeks ago, we bought a property in Louisiana. And we are in 11 states. We have three types of shopping centers: open air grocery, open air non-grocery, and then enclosed malls. We currently have 14 enclosed malls. And we're about to go under contract on a 15th one right now. Vertically integrated, we do everything in-house. We have our own in-house accounting, leasing, property management, construction management. Everything is done in-house. We have about 100 employees. And if you want to, we can delve into the Rockstep name and all that, or we can do that later.
Well, let's go into it now. I'd love to hear the kind of story behind the name, how it reflects company philosophy.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about it. Okay. That was a setup. Thank you for the setup. Okay. The word Rockstep is not a word in the dictionary. It is a dance move. So it comes from the swing era. Let's call it big band music, 50s, 60s, big band orchestra, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Peggy Lee, Rosemary Clooney, Sammy Davis Jr., that whole genre. Big band, when you swing dance, when you couples dance, you're rock stepping when you switch directions on count 7 and 8. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, rock step, like ball pivot change. Some people have heard that term, but rock step is a term that dancers use. And we use it as a metaphor to be agile, to be nimble, to be flexible, to listen to the music in the industry, which is always changing. And then we use it as a verb. So, you know, Cole, we got a problem, we need a rock step. Or Omar, we've got an opportunity, let's rock step. And everybody at the company knows what that means when we use it as a verb. My kids, my wife, everyone knows. This is a family issue. And then I wrote a set of behaviors, a set of rules, which I require everybody to live by. And it's not one rule, it's 25 rules. There's a lot of them, okay? So these are very specific behaviors. And I think you know the answer, but we call these rules, I'll give it to you, rock steps, okay? Sorry, we call them rock steps, and they're here. There's 25 of them. We have a rock step of the week, every week on a 25-week basis. We do it about twice a year. We've done it for 9 years. We have a rock step of the week, 10 o'clock, Monday. The whole company gets on a Teams call, and we talk about the rock step of the week. We are on rock step 15, invest in relationships. And so somebody in the company writes a little story about what does it mean for that rock to invest in relationships for them personally, for them professionally. And then they lead a discussion and then they call at random two or three people in the company. So everyone's got to think about, okay, if I'm getting called, I need to understand what does it mean to invest in relationships? And you have to, that's the discussion we do. So it's the language we've got and it's the behaviors we require. And this is how we hire people. Okay. What are your favorite three, Omar, rock steps? What are your most challenging three? And that is the part of your interview. It's a part of your interview. And so to come to Rockstep, and we're looking for great people, guys. We are, if you guys, if anybody listening here, we're looking for people in leasing and accounting and property management. If you really know your stuff, please let us know. And then to come here, you got to be good. To stay here, you got to follow the rock steps. Okay. And until you live with somebody, you really don't know if they're going to follow the rock steps, but that's what we require to build trust, to resolve conflict, to produce a great high-performance team. That's what we want. Can I share my favorite three and my most challenging? Is that all right?
I was going to turn your question back to you. Yeah, so sorry. What's your favorite three?
Favorite three, rock step number one. And you can go online to see the rock steps. It's right online, rockstep.com. So rock step number one is one of my three favorites, which is do the right thing always. We're in the investment business. The investment business is a world of gray. So you have to stop. Hey, guys, let's talk it through. How do we deal with this ambiguous issue as it relates to an investment, let's say? Another favorite is rock step number three. It's be punctual. On time is 5 minutes early. And if you're on time, you're late. It's about courteous, about respectful. I'm nut about being on time, about being punctual, paying our bills on time, starting a meeting on time, ending on time. It's about respect. Rock step 24 is another favorite. keep family first. You have to take care of your health. You have to take care of your family before you take care of Rockstep. Three most challenging. Rockstep number four, be a fanatic about response time. It's hard for me to keep up. There's just too much coming at you. So I've got to get a little bit better on being a fanatic about response time. Rockstep seven, another challenge, listen generously. My wife would confirm to both of you and to our listeners here that I have room for improvement in terms of listening. And I'm impatient. I think about what I want to say when somebody else, I need help on that one. Rockstep 25 is another one of my challenges. It's keep things fun. As my wife would say, I take the fun out of fun. Okay. So I'm very serious. I'm very happy on the inside. I think you guys know that. But on the outside, I'm very serious. My wife is very happy on the outside. On the inside, she's very nervous. So we kind of balance each other. I'm very passionate about the rock steps. Anybody can hold us accountable, hold me accountable, hold us accountable. We're required to live by these 25 rock steps, these rules of behavior. It's required. We're not perfect, but these are the standards we can be held accountable to. We're required to live by these with our tenants, our communities, our lenders, our investors, our professionals. This is the most important part of who we are. If we cannot find people who live by these rock steps, we will not grow our company. It is number one. There is no number two. That's it. So I can go to tears. If you want to take advantage of me, tell me you love the rock steps and I'll start crying. You can have whatever you want. Okay.
Well, you know, the company's been around a long time. I imagine the rock steps have not changed, but the company's had to evolve as the retail industry has. So I'm happy to tell us a little bit about how the company has evolved over the last close to 30 years.
Yeah. So again, we started out doing development. Development is hard. It's expensive. It takes a long time. We did basically Walmart Supercenter anchor deals. And then GFC came, Great Financial Crash. We started buying second generation. We started buying them in these hometown markets. And we have generally done second generation acquisition because in today's world, I don't think it's impossible to build new, but it's hard to build new. And so Amazon has changed our industry. It's destroyed many retailers. The good news is that in today's world, as a result of what's happened with COVID, the shopping center sector is the sector of yield. Compared to multifamily and industrial and certainly office, we are in favor. And people who are looking for investors, who are looking for yield for current cash flow, are now investing in retail, where 3 years, 4 years, 5 years ago, everybody was doing multifamily. And that was the place to be. And so our business is, I mean, it's a very exciting time for us because there's opportunities to buy properties that have positive leverage where your cap rate is higher and it's sometimes dramatically higher than the interest rate and the debt for the property. So we bought a property, grocery anchored center, 4 or 5 weeks ago in Louisiana. At a 9 cap, our debt was at 7%. So by adding debt, you're able to provide more yield, more cash flow to your investors. We're soon to be under contract on a mall that's an enclosed mall. It's part of it's open air, part of it's enclosed at an 18 cap. And we're borrowing at 7. It's between 6.75 and 7. We're not there yet, but it's called 7% at 50% leverage. There is so much cash flow that not only do you pay your current pref of 8%, but you can return 10% per year just without a refi. I mean, just through cash. And so the world has changed and we are now in favor, and Amazon, as with COVID, has really winnowed out, destroyed, closed the weak guys, and those that are left have been able to figure out how to compete with Amazon. They have their own distribution network. They actually, in some cases, distribute from the stores. They have a great app. And they're holding, if not gaining, market share against Amazon. But what's most important for the shopping center sector is that their balance sheets are good and they're telling Wall Street, we're going to grow by 25 stores, TJ Maxx, 200 stores, Ross, 150 stores, Aldi, 250 per year into an inventory of shopping centers that's not growing at all. So different than multifamily, different than industrial, all this new products coming on here in the shopping center sector, you have no new product, but you have all of these growth retailers that are growing into an inventory that's not growing. So if you own a shopping center, an open air center at 60, 70, 80% of replacement costs in a viable market, just by definition, that's a good story. Okay. If you own an enclosed mall at a 15 cap in a viable market, that's an even better story. Okay. We've evolved. We have become a hometown focused company, and a hometown, I'm going to define it, is a market under a million people. It could be 100,000, maybe 250,000, could be 500,000, but generally under a million, where there is a quality of life, there is low crime, there's community engagement, there is business and civic leadership that make a difference, that are active at the community level. And so that's a characteristic of one of the characteristics of a hometown, why we like them. And then for a hometown to be viable as an investment for us, it's got to have something that's driving population growth. We call it an essential driver. It's got to have at least one of the following. It's got to have major tourism, a very strong hospital district, a major university, a Fortune 1000 company or company, something driving employment growth, or military base, or military research. Military theme is a very important theme for this country because we are remilitarizing. There will be more soldiers, there will be more military production, there will be more research. And if your property is adjacent to a military base or a research facility, that's an essential driver as well. So you're looking for great assets in what we call hometowns at the right price. And then we add a couple other ingredients to this strategy. And that is when we buy an enclosed mall in particular in a hometown, we will get local business leaders to be part of our investment pretty much every time. And so I'm going to a hometown in 2 weeks. I'm going to be meeting with between 15 and 25 business leaders. I expect that 3, 4, 5, 10 might raise their hand and want to come in on the deal, pari passu, equal to my equity and either investor equity. And by having business leaders that live in that community, part of the equity, it allows us to reduce risk. They help with local investors, help with entitlements, property taxes, incentives. They're effectively deputized leasing agents for alternative uses. They're on the boards of the community college, the hospital district, the economic development district. They're piped in to all these opportunities. And while we know how to run a shopping center, these shopping centers are part of a community, and there's risk and opportunity that you can deal with by having local investors. Combine that with another piece of our strategy, and that's community bank debt. We get very favorable market debt terms by having a community bank lender who wants to invest in that hometown and active in that hometown. And often our local investors are on the board of that bank. So it's all about reducing risk, doing what's right for the hometown, getting the community involved. It's a tremendous amount of fun. And I would say that everybody at our company is energized by that mission.
I'm glad you went ahead and defined hometowns. I know that you guys have the Hometown America Fund.
Yes.
And you've said that this has really supported speeding up deal making. Want to walk us through how that's structured?
Sure. We have moved to a fund model because, particularly in the enclosed mall space, when I use the word enclosed mall, I'm talking about a property that has a portion of it that's open air and a portion of it's enclosed. And the sellers, which are usually lenders, they are requiring that the buyer have committed capital, usually in the form of a fund, in order to be awarded the deal. So very important investment. You got to be able to buy it right. And without a fund, you can't buy it right for many of the assets, which we think are a great investment. So we have moved from a syndication model to a little bit of a hybrid. Okay, so we've got the fund, Hometown America, closed-end fund. And at when we buy a property, like the one we're going to be buying in fourth quarter, local investors will invest at the deal level, at the asset level. And so we allow investors to come in at the fund level or at the asset level. So there's some investors that like the opportunity, like the strategy, and like the diversification in the fund. Others say, you know what, I want to invest, just that I want to kick the tires. We provide co-investment opportunities at the deal level. The fund is targeting an 18% IRR with an 8 to 9% preferred return, cash flow day one. We are buying yield day one, not in a year, 5 years, 10 years, day one. We should be able to pay a preferred return of 8 to 9%, depending upon how much somebody invests. If you invest over $1 million, you get a 9% preferred. If you invest under $1 million, it's a 8.5% preferred. Better split at the back end after investors get all their capital back. If you invest over $1 million, it's under $1 million, it's a little bit of a smaller split. So that's how we structure it. It will be 5 to 7 properties. All of them will be in hometown. Some will be enclosed malls. Some will be open air centers. The enclosed malls are the higher yield, the more opportunistic type of play. The open air centers are less opportunistic, a little bit more value add, a little bit less risky, but the returns are also a little bit lower. So you meld them together, you get diversification, you get cash, and you're mixing some open air with high yield enclosed malls.
And one thing that you've lived through is the retail apocalypse narrative playing out.
Yep.
And we've shifted to the new equivalent fun name for the theme is the retail renaissance that we're currently living in. And I'm curious because you've noted that even pure e-commerce brands eventually need stores. How do you see this kind of retail renaissance continuing to play out? And is it something that physical retail stores are going to continue to benefit?
Yes, I think it's a great question. Let's talk a little bit about the Amazon effect and the retail renaissance. Retail is here to stay. And so many investors might be concerned about, you know, is retail going to, you know, I get Amazon packages every day. The answer is retail is here to stay. Retailers that are here today have a e-commerce strategy, or they have an experiential type of store. And I'm using TJ Maxx as an example. So one of the biggest sectors of growth in shopping centers is the off-pricers. TJ Maxx, all of their divisions, Ross, Nordstrom Rack, Burlington. Between them, they're opening up 500 to 750 stores a year, okay? And they have rock-solid balance sheets. And while they do have a little bit of e-commerce for them, women in particular, they like the fun of shopping at these stores. You're also having restaurants, you're having fitness, you're having service, you're having, let's use Hobby Lobby, take your kids and go buy crafts. These stores have figured out how to compete against Amazon. In addition, pure plays, no stores, have a problem. They start out with a very low cost of customer acquisition. And then as these pure plays, again, no stores, as they want to grow their business, the cost of customer acquisition rises. And it rises dramatically. You have to buy ads. You've got to buy Google ads. You've got to do all these things to drive new customers. And what they have found is that the lowest cost of new customer acquisition is a physical store. And it protects the brand at the lowest cost. And when a pure play opens up a store, not only are their sales good, but there's a halo effect. And the halo effect says my e-commerce grows as well. And so 1 + 1 = 3. People like Wayfair, they're opening stores. My glasses, Warby Parker. Okay. They were pure play. Now they're opening up lots and lots of stores, and 1 + 1 = 2. That is what they're finding. They can grow their brand. They can protect their brand. They can get new customers. I would not have gone and gotten my glasses at Warby Parker if it was purely online. I would have done it. Okay. Now I can reorder online if I want to. And so that phenomenon is happening everywhere. So the demand for shopping center space, vacancies going down, occupancies going up, combine that with the fact that construction costs have gone up by 40% in the last 3 years, combine that with interest rates going up by on average 4 to 5%. Now it's 6.5 to 7.5%. So it's gone up by, let's call it 250, 300 basis points. The cost of construction has gone up so high, and retailer, let's call it by 40, if you include debt, the cost of debt, 40 to 50%, retailer sales have not gone up by 40 to 50%. Therefore, their rents are not going up by 40 to 50%. Therefore, they want to grow, but they don't want, you can't afford to build new. So if you own second generation at 60 to 80% of replacement costs for open air, or at 20% of replacement costs for enclosed malls, it's the supply demand dynamics are in your favor. And you've got this positive leverage where your cap rate is higher than your interest rate, different than multifamily. Multifamily valued in Houston outside my window at a 5 cap, but you're borrowing at 6. So you've got negative leverage. So the only way to make those deal work is if you have dramatic increases in rents and net operating income over a short period of time. We call that a strategy of prayer. Prayer is not a great strategy in real estate. I think it's a great strategy in life, but in real estate, I don't think that should be the dominant strategy one depends on.
Yeah, I haven't seen many funds launch with that prayer strategy, but or at least calling it out, right? I guess, so some of it, this supply and demand dynamic that you just very well articulated, that makes me think that some of the yields that you were mentioning up front are very impressive. And this supply and demand dynamic that you've explained makes me think that there's still room to run in terms of the retail sector being like quite attractive and there still being quite a few opportunities.
Well, look,
is that the right?
Yes, our pipeline greatly exceeds our capital. That's why we're fundraising into our fund. And look, you have to layer in it that the stock market is frothy and there are more and more investors, whether high net worth, ultra high net worth, or family office investors, who part of them thinks that the market is too frothy and they want to move to some type of alternatives. Real estate's the dominant alternative. And then within real estate, you have to choose your sector. So most folks have not considered shopping centers in the last period of time. They've been in primarily multifamily and industrial, and those sectors have stress. Retail doesn't have stress. The Amazon effect is matured. These companies that have survived the Amazon and COVID effect can effectively compete, and they're growing. So you've got great supply-demand dynamics in our industry. You've got positive leverage. And so those of your listeners who are looking to place money into commercial real estate and who want income, who want yield, you should think about shopping centers. There's some very good operators out there. There's other people beside us. And so you should just be open to the concept and learn more about it. So you can go to our website, rockstep.com. We have a learning center. We've got well over 100 articles on every aspect of shopping centers for people who aren't that familiar with the shopping center sector. We've got videos on every single aspect of it. Again, you had mentioned we have a YouTube channel called the Shopping Center Channel. On Instagram, I'm the Shopping Center Guy. So there's all sorts of ways for people to educate themselves. It's all about education, the good and the bad associated with shopping centers. So we've got a long history. We've learned a lot of lessons. We love what we do. Investment is all about thinking about the alternatives. And I would just suggest that people who've got all their money in the market, that they think about alternatives. And if they're going to think about alternatives, at least consider the retail sector if they like yield. Okay. Now, if you like development risk and take it all on the back end, that's one thing. We don't like that type of development risk.
I'd be shocked if anybody said they don't like yield. But one thing that I'm curious, at kind of a macro level, we've seen that the consumption has been very strong within the U.S. for many years. Overall, aggregate consumption plays such a huge role in our economy that it's hard to see it disappearing. However, we're also seeing that a huge portion of that consumption is coming from a smaller and smaller group. Is that something that is on your radar, or it's that you've really given any thought to?
Sure. I think it's a great question. I would contend that the consumer is under stress, and they're under stress in much more subtle ways. And there is tremendous stress out there. And very frankly, I look at the stock market at all-time highs, and I think we're heading towards a recession. I think the tariffs are going to produce inflation. Inflation will produce a decrease in the standard of living. I think the job market, it's tough. Every signal that I read says caution. Okay. Now, does that mean don't invest in real estate? Don't invest in shopping centers? Who knows? Okay. Is it better to keep all your money in cash, pile it in the market, diversify in alternatives? Look, it's easy to be negative in the world. It's easy. It's harder to be optimistic. Okay. Even though we live in the best country and life is great in the United States of America, there is stress out there. And how it's going to play out in the overall economy, how it's going to play out in the commercial real estate, is you've got to study it. You got to think about it. You've got to worry about it. And then you've got to run your business and build your investments the best way you can.
Are there any either in the market that you think are underappreciated or underpriced, or opportunities that are overpriced? Just any kind of mispricing, well, whether that's at the macro or...
Sure. So in the shopping center sector, there is no doubt that the enclosed mall space is dramatically underpriced. Okay. If you can buy a stable cash flow asset in a strong market at a 15 cap or higher, and you have optionality because these are well-located tracks that, I mean, we own 14 malls. Some are being demalled, some are selling the periphery, some are working just great the way they are. You've got all of these different options. That is an underpriced opportunity. Now, the challenge is it's very difficult to operate. It's probably one of the most challenging subsectors in all of commercial real estate, because there's all sorts of moving pieces. But that's what we do. That's what we've been doing. And I think we understand those moving pieces. And then if you can combine in it some of this community investor, community lender, community support, I think it's an underappreciated opportunity in my mind. And then the only thing I'll say is just to emphasize what I said earlier, this tariff thing is going to have an impact on our economy, and we're in the first inning of feeling it. We're in the first.
Getting a little more tactical, I think the enclosed mall space is super interesting, and I want to hear a little more about how you decide between maintaining something, upgrading it, repositioning it.
Sure.
I'm curious.
So what you do is you look at the asset in the market, and you look at its location, and you look at the sales in of your tenants, and what is the ability for some of the smaller tenants to leave your property and go into vacancy into a competitive location. So if there's opportunities to do that, where they could leave into an open air competitive location in that market, then you want to think about a redevelopment opportunity, getting rid of part of your space and doing something different. If, however, there's not a lot of open space and you're in the pole position, the best location, and new construction, there's not incentives to do new construction by the community, and the tenants do well, and the occupancy costs are low, and the center has got lots of great tenants and is 90% plus full, that's a story for a stable NOI play. Okay, so it depends. And there is opportunity to redevelop. We just opened up a hockey arena in one of our shopping centers in Wisconsin, a $50 million hockey arena where the Sears was. And the city invested $50 million on our property. And we'll end up doing a hotel and multifamily there. Okay, as a result, in addition with retail, so it'll be mixed use. It'll be sports complex. It will be a convention center, retail with Kohl's and Dick's and Ulta. And then there will be some residential and hospitality there as well. Mixed use in a wonderful hometown. And another property, we're demolishing everything except for one or two of the anchors that we're going to put in a Target store. There's all these different opportunities depending upon the strength of the tenants, the strength of the market. You make an assessment as you acquire what type of asset that will be. Can you maintain an operating income stable? Forget about increasing it. We do increase, but at the minimum, if you have stable NOI at a mid-teens cap rate at 50% leverage with flexible bank debt, life is good.
So I think the hockey arena is a great example of one, but I'm curious if you have any other good examples of an instance where working with maybe a public-private collaboration with some civic leaders created outsized value for you guys.
Yeah, so in Hutchinson, Kansas, we're turning a mall inside out. The city supported us with an economic development district sales tax incentive program, and that will provide several hundred jobs for this community, high quality of life, and a great return to our investors. Okay. And so in northern Minnesota, the city and the local IRRB has granted us probably $4 to $4.5 million to demol an asset and produce retail tenants like Hobby Lobby and Aldi and Tractor Supply and Harbor Freight. And we're opening up a TJ Maxx, Marshall's division. All of that was done with public-private partnerships. So we're really good at identifying opportunities and implementing incentives through public-private partnerships.
So one thing you mentioned earlier in our conversation was one of the things that makes some of these hometown deals great is that you have a lot of folks in on the deal who are effectively deputized leasing agents. So I want to hear a little bit about how you balance that demand from small local tenants versus those very in-demand credit national tenants.
Well, look, in a market that is a hometown by our definition, if you have local tenants and national tenants, and you have lots of them, that's a good thing. And generally, you'll choose the national tenants if they do a lot of volume and if they're investment grade credit. Okay. So in other words, they're going to be around in 20 years. If it's local regional, you have to balance what's the alternative. If there's four tenants wanting to come into a space or none, and then you'll work with a local or regional because it's your best option.
So I'm curious too, investing in some of these smaller markets, there are probably some issues you wouldn't encounter in secondary and tertiary markets, or that you would encounter there that you would not in a primary market. You have any insight on what some of those might be?
Well, there's a couple that there could be. One is a difficult property tax environment. Sometimes you can have markets where the market value of the property taxes are not represented in the appraisal district. So sometimes you'll have jurisdictions, evaluation jurisdictions that say, you know what, even though it's worth $10 million because you bought it for $10 million, it's on the rolls for $30 million. And I'm an elected politician and my job is to maximize tax revenue and I'm going to lose my job. And so sometimes you have a situation where you can't get to market properties. That's one. Second one is, depending upon where you are in the country, you have property insurance issues and exposure. So on the coast, you have wind, hurricane exposure. In various parts of the country, you have hail exposure. You know, you just have more geography that is exposed to insurance fluctuations. You got to deal with it. You got to spend a lot of time managing your insurance risk. And we spend a lot of time doing that. So there are differences.
So I wanted to ask one more kind of tactical related question. I mean, I know you guys have grown your portfolio fairly significantly over the last few years, but you've probably sold some as well. So I'm curious to know a little bit about your philosophy on your exit strategy. What drives that decision to?
So our typical hold period is 5 to 6 years. Our goal in our fund is an 18% IRR, 2X, double people's money over 5 or 6 years. And at the same time, if we buy a property, and the day after we buy it, somebody wants it for more money, we'll sell it. Like there's no magic. And then in 5 or 6 years, if the markets are terrible, interest rates are high, or there's some bad news, or there's a COVID, we're not going to be forced to sell just because it's 5 years. We'll hold it for an additional year or two until things stabilize. But our goal is a 2X over 5 to 6 years. That's our thinking.
I have two more questions for you. They'll be a little bit lighter. We understand that you're a bit of a fan of Chick-fil-A.
Yes. So I am, and this could ruin my image. It's a little quirky, but I eat Chick-fil-A more than anybody who listens to your podcast. I guarantee it. I have Chick-fil-A for breakfast. This is when I'm not traveling, but I travel a lot. I have Chick-fil-A for breakfast 6 days a week, for lunch 7 days a week, and for part of dinner 4 days a week. And I am a Chick-fil-A One member, and me and four of my friends have been invited to Chick-fil-A's headquarters as a guest of Chick-fil-A. And so this Friday, 2 days from now, at 1:30, I've got a tour of their headquarters. My wife's going to go. My son's going to be in Atlanta. He's going to go. And so I've got a Chick-fil-A diet. That's my Chick-fil-A diet. I'm a Chick-fil-A One member. They're a great company. I'm going to go sit on the red couch, and I'm going to go eat lunch at the Dwarf House, which is the original Chick-fil-A right next to the headquarters in southern Atlanta. And it's fun. It's fun. Chick-fil-A runs an amazing operation. There'll be a Chick-fil-A that does 12 million 6 days a week next to a McDonald's that does 2.7 million 7 days a week. They have figured it out, and they just know how to move people through a drive-thru. They are the best.
That's amazing. And for a final question, we like to ask all our guests the same question. So if you could snap your fingers and have any change to the industry come true, what would it be?
To the shopping center industry.
It could be shopping center industry. It could be broader retail real estate. It could be all of real estate.
Look, if I could snap my fingers for anything, I would say that there is such opportunity right now in shopping centers and in particularly in enclosed malls. And our pipeline is bigger than the current equity we have for that pipeline. So if I can snap, we would have a lot of investors, family offices, institutional investors align with us, take advantage of us, of the opportunity, and we roll it out. We recruit all the major REITs. So there's a lot of people who are in stagnant companies, and we've got a wonderful bench of opportunities as we acquire to bring in very highly skilled people that we hope lives by the rock steps. Okay. You got to live together for a little bit to see if they live by the rock steps, but we'll keep our fingers crossed on that one.
Excellent. Well, Andy, I wanted to thank you so much for being with us. Really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Remember, rockstep.com, Learning Center. if you or if any of your guests want to just understand a little bit more about how this sector works.
Excellent. So I think that's all the time we've got, but want to thank you for joining. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in, and everybody take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.